The National Broadcasting Company's News and Special Events Department brings you Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week. You'll hear Andrei Vyshinsky, Trygve Lie, General Eisenhower, Franklin Roosevelt Jr., Admiral Denfeld, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, here is your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
This happened last night in Madison Square Garden.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's forget the fight for just a moment, please. Today, the sports world suffered a great loss in the deaths of Marcel Cerdan and his manager, Joe Longman. Boxing can never forget them. It seems altogether fitting that all of us should stand now in tribute to these two fine citizens of France who are no longer with us.
Thus did American fight fans who gathered to see Sandy Sadler win over Paddy DeMarco pay tribute to Marcel Cerdan, the gallant French boxer who died along with 47 others in the crash of a transatlantic airliner that plunged in flames at an outpost in the Azores. Today, NBC correspondent Henry Cassidy in Paris reports on a nation in mourning.
It's no exaggeration to say all of France is in mourning today for Marcel Cerdan. The death of the boxer with 47 other persons yesterday in the crash of a French airplane on its way to New York is the solemn subject of virtually every conversation and by far the biggest story in every newspaper. The boy from Casablanca, who became middleweight champion of the world, has certainly become the most popular figure in death of post-war France.
And America, too, mourns the passing of the little guy with the great fighting heart.
After the angry days and bitter words of the Navy hearings, there came positive action this week.
This man was fired.
My name is Louis Denfeld. I am an admiral in the United States Navy and chief of naval operations. As a senior military spokesman for the Navy, I want to state forthwith that I fully support the broad conclusions presented to this committee by the naval and marine officers who have preceded me.
Admiral Denfeld, according to the White House, had failed to back up military unification, and for that reason, he was out as chief of naval operations. Reaction from Congress was immediate, and for the most part, angry. The hearings before the House Armed Services Committee had seen an echelon of high Navy officers appear to denounce the defense planning that cut back the Navy. And with news of Denfeld's ouster, aroused members of the committee recalled the opening words of Chairman Vinson. No retaliation, he said. And then, too, said these congressmen, the same Navy Secretary Matthews, who was now recommending the firing of Denfeld, had come before the committee in previous weeks to say,
"Let me assure the committee that any naval officer or enlisted man or any Navy civilian whom your committee wants to hear or who desires to be heard by your committee is completely free to testify. There has been no censorship. There will be none."
Within hours after Denfeld was fired, one committee member was recalling those very words. Representative Ahrens of Illinois was indignant. Listen.
Secretary of the Navy Matthews opened the recent hearings on national defense before the House Armed Services Committee with the unequivocal assertion that all naval officers would have the full right to express their views. Despite these assertions that these promises made to the Congress, we now see a campaign of terror being initiated in the Pentagon, a dictatorial, tyrannical, despotic, controlled mechanism designed to dictate to all people in the national defense structure what they may or may not say to the American people through their elected representatives in the Congress. I sincerely hope that all Americans who cherish the right of expressing themselves freely on public matters will rise together in protest against this high-handed, arbitrary, dictatorial attitude, which smacks far more of the Kremlin than of the capital of the United States.
But others said Denfeld was dropped not for speaking out, but because his attitude indicated he could not in good faith work on the new, supposedly unified defense team. At week's end, Congressman announced that hearings would be reopened after January 1950.
Not all of Washington was concerned this week with matters of international import. For the residents of this hectic city, there was also the problem of the tuneful trolleys.
Well, some liked it, and some were very vigorous in saying they wanted no part of it. Recorded music and commercials from radios installed in streetcars and buses in Washington. The argument got so hot that the Washington Utilities Commission ordered hearings on the pros and cons of this real-life trolley song.
Since the 1st of July to date, there have been 180 streetcars involved in traffic accidents, of which 26 were equipped with radios. Over the same period of time, there were 125 buses involved in accidents, six of which were equipped with radios. The department is neutral insofar as the equipment of vehicles with radios are concerned.
Well, that was the neutral position of the Capitol's police department. But the everyday commuters brought considerable confusion to the hearings. And when the musical streetcars were ringingly denounced, the audience bombarded the commission with applause.
We want you ladies to enjoy yourself, but applause or indication of disapproval has no weight in the decision that the commission has to make.
And then there was this lady who didn't mind at all a few gentle commercials and a little music during the ride.
I believe we seem to like the music simply because when we come home tired and get on a streetcar, the moment we hear the music, the tension relaxes, and when we get off, we feel in a much better mood.
Yes, there are those who leave the office after a hard day, board their streetcar, push their way to a seat, open the newspaper, and then sit back to relax. Well, if you don't like it, you can always walk.
The gray sky over Manhattan gave way to a bright October sun as men of all beliefs gathered this week for a renewed promise of peace.
The 237th plenary meeting of the General Assembly is now in session.
That's the way it began when the World Parliament met in open session in New York's East Side. Towering above the delegates was the yet unfinished structure of the United Nations headquarters building. Crowds of housewives with baby carriages, workmen with their hammers silent, looked on as the dedication of this new world capital began. The people of the state of New York had turned over to all the people of the earth a plot of their ground. Governor Thomas E. Dewey spoke for them and their faith in the United Nations.
It is stronger today than ever before. It is my hope, and I know the hope of all of you, that these mighty buildings here will symbolize the growing might of the United Nations in the best cause of all, the cause of peace and goodwill on earth.
Blue and white banners of the United Nations rustled gently in the air as the UN Secretary General Trygve Lie guided the massive cornerstone into place.
It is with a profound sense of the historic significance of this occasion that I proceed to dedicate the cornerstone of the permanent headquarters of the United Nations.
And the band struck up Hail to the Chief. The delegate from Arab Yemen and the clerk from Karnassi strained for a look at the next speaker.
The President of the United States.
Distinguished representatives and fellow guests. These are the most important buildings in the world, for they are the center of man's hope for peace and a better life. This is the place where the nations of the world will work together to make that hope a reality.
On this occasion, President Truman took as his major topic a problem that's among the UN's gravest concerns. Listen.
I should like to speak of one other problem, which is of major concern to the United Nations. That is the control of atomic energy. The establishment of the United Nations Atomic Energy Commission was one of the first acts of the first session of the General Assembly. That commission worked for 3 years on the problem. It developed a plan of control which reflected valuable contributions by almost every country represented on the commission. This is a good plan. We support this plan and will continue to support it unless or until a better and more effective plan is put forward.
Yes, the dispute over control of atomic energy was again brought to the foreground by the president's speech. Perhaps here, time to listen again to what this dispute is all about, what we of the West are asking, and why the East refuses. Hear it from the newsman who covers the UN beat, NBC's Leon Pearson.
The primary obstacle is that we want more, much more than international inspection. We want the scrapping of all national production and processing of atomic materials and the surrender of all such mines and plants to an international authority. Yes, this means that we would surrender our own uranium and plutonium resources, our own atomic plants, Oak Ridge, Hanford, our own stocks of atom bombs to an international authority. Not only for inspection by that authority, but for ownership and control by that authority. But in doing so, we would expect the same surrender from all other powers so that Russia, like us, would no longer have national control over her own atomic enterprises. This is what the Russians cannot swallow, what they call sticking our noses into other people's business. They will admit inspection, but they will not surrender their plans to a foreign body, even though they are represented on that body.
Aside from the pageantry of the dedication ceremonies, the UN made news this week when it came to grips with the feud between Belgrade and Moscow.
A dramatic moment in the halls at Flushing Meadow when the UN elected Tito's Yugoslavia to a seat on the Security Council. Russia's Vyshinsky thundered in vain anger. This was a violation of a gentleman's agreement among the big powers, but there being no word for gentleman in the Russian language, Vyshinsky used the English word. Listen and hear Assembly President Romulo pound his gavel to rule the Russian out of order.
Действовала на всех предыдущих выборах. В 1946 году, в 1947 году и 1948 году Советский Союз настаивает на одном. Джентльменское соглашение должно существовать для джентльменов.
A chair rules the remarks just heard entirely out of order.
Pointing up the West's obvious help to Tito in his struggle with the common form was the appointment this week of a top American diplomat as our new ambassador to Belgrade. He's George Allen, former chief of the Voice of America, who returned from a conference of American envoys behind the Iron Curtain and reported to newsmen at New York's airport.
We have just had in London a meeting of the ambassadors from the behind the Iron Curtain. It was a most successful meeting. We explored all the problems that are of mutual interest to our representative from behind the Iron Curtain countries. I learned a great deal of the type of problems that I shall face undoubtedly in my new post, of a different type somewhat, but in general the same type of things in Yugoslavia.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
Well, not so merry old England rolled with another punch this week. The government announced a tightening of their austerity program. Now, to some Americans, the words welfare state connote something dark and ugly. But in England, until and unless an election proves them wrong, the Labour government goes ahead with what it honestly calls the welfare state and its present hardships. To his people this week, Prime Minister Clement Attlee spoke of more of the same.
I have told you that the position is critical. We have a great opportunity to set things right. Let us seize it. In their sphere, the government have taken vigorous action. I ask you all, men and women, to play your part and help to bring the country through.
Well, there was mighty good news for Dollar Short Britain from Broadway this week. One recent export was really paying off. Yes, the ballet. New York's dance lovers and critics have been loud in their acclaim of the famous Sadler's Wells Ballet Troupe, which is packing them in to the Metropolitan Opera House like a hit musical comedy, and tickets are almost as scarce. Voices and Events decided to check up on this bonanza for Britain by talking with Madame Nanette de Valois, director and founder of the ballet company. We asked Madame, tell us something about your troupe.
Well, it's a leading English ballet company and was founded about 15 years ago at the Sadler's Wells Theatre. We've had the most amazing reception from you all over here, a very generous one.
Do you find that American tastes differ from those of, say, those in Britain?
No, they are very well informed about the ballet, and they seem to know all our dancers by name. But what we do find, of course, they are not used to the three-act classical ballets. And it was rather a shot in the dark giving them these full-length ballets for the first time, but they've absolutely adored them. We decided to bring 12 ballets with us, and three of them are full-length classical works. And the other works are modern ballets, and they cover a period of work for the last 15 years. Well, we have our own school, and most of the members of this company have graduated from the school. At least I would say 85% at least of them.
You know, we're so used in ballet to hearing long Russian names. Where are the Russians in your company?
We have two.
Was that so? Well, Madame Valois, our correspondent in Britain, tells us that everyone back there is happy not only for your artistic success, but for the scarce dollars you're earning for your country. Here's what Merrill Muller says.
The London press and all Britain has hailed the success of the Sadler Wells Ballet in New York. The British, you know, like to point with pride to the quality of their exports. To this nation, Sadler Wells proves the point.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. We realized that not only America was watching us, but England was.
In other words, you had to bring home the bacon.
That's right.
Well, you certainly did. And thanks very much.
Yes, the familiar waltz from Sleeping Beauty. The classic ballets are a remarkable hit in New York, and this magnificent company is soon to set out on a cross-country tour, bringing the little-known splendor and pageantry of the ballet to many parts of our nation.
A time of politics this week as the New York Herald Tribune called together in a forum leaders of both major political parties.
Among the major figures of government and international affairs who gathered to discuss our world and our nation was a cross-section of American politics, men like freshman Congressman Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jr. No need for explaining what kind of Democrat he was, so young Roosevelt spoke instead on why he was not a Republican.
Before the days of the general use of airplanes, I remember as a little boy riding backward on a train. It seems to me that the Republican Party may well be compared to a man riding backward on a train. He never sees what there is to see until the train has gone past, and he never quite grasps what he saw until he is far, far beyond it. The Republican Party... The Republican Party has been this stubborn, backwards-riding passenger on the train of history for nearly two decades.
The Mason-Dixon line divides the nation and the Democrats. And from the South, to state his position, came Virginia's representative, Howard Smith.
I am what may be termed a conservative Democrat. It is one who finds his normal habitat south of the Mason and Dixon line. We conservative Democrats believe in certain fundamental principles embedded in the Bill of Rights. We are unwilling to surrender our convictions to meet every real or fancied emergency that may arise in a modern world, distressed and torn by the swarms of strange ideologies sweeping over the earth. These conservative Democrats refuse to either marry, betroth, court, or flirt with any of these foreign innovations in government.
New to his job as governor of Illinois is independent-minded Democrat Adlai Stevenson. Here's what he told the forum on being a Democrat.
The subject that you've assigned me, what kind of a Democrat I am, makes me feel a little like the old lady in Vermont who once told me that she didn't know what she thought until she heard what she said. The fact of the matter is, I don't know. I'm not sure what kind of a Democrat I am, but I am sure what kind of a Democrat I am not. I'm not one of those who believe that we should have a Democratic regime because it is good for the Democratic Party. If the Democratic Party is not good for the nation, it is not good for Democrats, nor for me. I have no fixed principles by which every issue is to be automatically resolved. I do not identify big government with good government. I entertain no ambition for the Democratic Party to set the track record for what President Hoover has recently called the last mile to socialism.
Next, it's the Republicans' turn, and the younger element of the party was represented by the son of the late Wendell Willkie, Indiana legislator Philip Willkie.
The Republican Party, it needs a program. It needs it badly. The party is identified in the minds of most Americans as being against most of the social and economic programs which have been presented to the American people in the last two decades.
Young Willkie went on to say there was a middle way for government responsibility to the people and cited the Federal Reserve System as a pattern for public policy. Next from the GOP ranks came Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, also to talk of the need for a positive program.
Now this means first that we must have a program. Secondly, that this program must be such as to put us on a competitive basis with the Democrats. Does not mean me too, of course. But neither does it mean mere negation, being against them when they're right. If the Republican Party is to return to a position of greatest national usefulness, it must take inspiration from its progressive past, and this must certainly make a vigorous, sincere, and successful effort to win the confidence of the rank and file of labor. There is no place in the Republican Party for reactionaries, as distinguished from conservatives, and I make that distinction, who, like the royalists in European republics, refuse to accept changes which are here to stay.
And from the far west, there came another Republican to this forum. If it can be said that the party has a left wing, well, its chief exponent might be the senator from Oregon, Wayne Morse.
We must show the independent voters of America that the federal government can promote the general welfare of our people without sacrificing local self-government and without endangering constitutional checks and safeguards against an over-centralized and arbitrary executive branch.
Perhaps the words of one man this week could not be ascribed to any particular political party, but in any event, there was a definition of principle and belief from General Dwight Eisenhower.
What kind of government ahead? The responsibility of every citizen. There, in 10 words, is the most important question of our day and the nub of the American political philosophy. We believe in human dignity, in human rights not subject to arbitrary forfeiture or curtailment. We believe that these rights can be fully possessed and effectively exercised only so long as man asserts and maintains himself the master, not the serf, of institutions he creates.
Eisenhower spoke, too, of the great strike slowly strangling the country. Serious cracks were showing from the strain of the coal and steel walkouts. Not yet a national emergency, the president said, but the question of moral responsibility was in the mind of General Eisenhower.
Two great American industries are today shut down because a few men cannot see eye to eye on specific items of employee and employer responsibility. If they, of undoubted loyalty to America, can dare calamity by their failure to agree in a far more simple decision, how can the plain citizen determine the dividing line between his own and his government's responsibility?
24 hours ago, the Federal Reserve Board had this to say of the continuing steel and coal strikes. The impact will push industrial production this month to the lowest point in almost 4 years. But the wearying struggle goes on without a sign of a break. And CIO President Philip Murray continues to carry his story to the steelworkers.
The steel companies have, with some exceptions, overlooked the fact that the machines and plant on which the industry has prospered and on which it must depend in the future are not all made of metal or brick and mortar. They are also made of flesh and blood. These human machines need the same kind of treatment for depreciation and disability that other machines are getting.
Well, add to this picture of the labor situation, the CIO National Convention. It's coming up next week in Cleveland, Ohio. It's put Murray on the spot, or so one newsman decided after studying the facts. Hear it now from NBC's Clifton Utley.
One thing that complicates Mr. Murray's position is that shortly before the steel strike began, Walter Reuther, the automobile worker's head, got a non-contributory pension system from the Ford Motor Company. For Mr. Murray now to settle for less than Reuther was able to get for his auto workers would put Murray in the position of lowered prestige at the very moment on the eve of the CIO convention when he is in the greatest need of every bit of prestige he can get. Murray's need for prestige during the CIO convention period this year is greater than usual, for it is common knowledge that at the coming convention, Murray is going to make a determined effort to end the power of communist-controlled unions within the CIO. In these circumstances, it's reasonably clear that Murray, until the CIO convention meets and adjourns, cannot accept a strike settlement on any terms less than his present demands.
Farm folks in their Sunday best turned out one day this week in a little community a few score miles from Chicago. It was an occasion they'll never forget.
It seemed unbelievable at first to farmer Albert Miles. This world-renowned figure, this guest of kings and presidents, had asked, humbly, to dine at his house, to sample the food of a typical American farmer. There was deep meaning to this request from Prime Minister Nehru of India, leader of a land where so many millions are hungry. With his official party, Nehru visited Albert Miles and his family, ate dinner with them, and when he'd left, NBC took its microphones to the kitchen of the Miles home to learn all about it from the family. And the sound you hear in the background, well, those are the dishes being washed.
We served 22 people, and we served two in the kitchen. We had mashed chicken, mashed potatoes and gravy, cranberry sauce, apple salad, relishes, cream peas, buttered corn, cottage cheese, rolls and homemade jelly, homemade butter, apple pie, cheese.
And coffee.
Coffee and milk.
Uh-huh. What kind of an appetite does the Prime Minister have?
I thought he enjoyed his food very much this noon.
Did he eat quite a bit, do you think?
Well, I think he did.
Your daughter says he had a good appetite.
Yes, I thought he ate with relish.
This has been Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You've heard the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor, James Fleming. This is Robert Warren. Listen next week for Voices and Events.
Today is Saturday, and today marks an important event in the musical calendar, the start of another winter series of concerts by the NBC Symphony Orchestra. And tonight, the world's most celebrated conductor, Arturo Toscanini, returns to the podium to lead the orchestra in a special program featuring the music of Berlioz and Debussy. It's a top-flight musical event on NBC, Arturo Toscanini and the NBC Symphony. You're tuned for the stars on NBC.